Hello and welcome back to the Millennial Ag Podcast, where agriculture is always on tap and no topic is off limits. Thanks for joining us today, your co-hosts, Valene Cawhorn and Catherine Lotsbeach.
Hey guys, welcome to this week's episode. It has been quite a while since Valene and I have done a market update. You guys know that we do that periodically from the beef and dairy perspectives because that's where we come from and that's what we love. And we have had a ton of great content this year. The last 6 months have shown us, you know, tackling some of the really big issues. We've, of course, done our main mental health series. We've done a few other cool episodes, you know, kind of standalones in the last several weeks. And we thought that it was time to do a market update because there's been a lot of movement across the board in the protein sector. Obviously, politics, tariffs, policies, economics, environmental factors, you know, geopolitics for sure are certainly throwing everything that they have at the markets. And so we decided it was time for an update. So just a real quick scene set. Dairy's gaining ground. Beef's been navigating a lot of pressures that you've heard us talk about before. And we've got big questions around this. Number one, is this growth sustainable? And what does it mean for producers? Because that's always what we come back to. Producers are mine and Valene's main focus, both personally and professionally. So, you know, we're kind of looking at what is the optimism here and what are some of the operational pressures? So Val, where should we start?
Well, that's a really good question because I think there's a lot we can dive into and a lot of different directions that we can head into on discussing this. But I think to preface it too, Catherine and I are hobby market followers. We are not experts by any stretch of the imagination. We kind of know where to find our stats and find it interesting. So this episode may involve more questions than we have answers. We'll be doing, obviously, follow-up episodes on this, and it will focus primarily on beef and dairy because that's where we reside. So maybe to get started, Catherine, do you want to paint a picture of where we're seeing trends as far as demand for animal protein in general, whether it be beef or dairy? Because I think there's some congruent consumer demands across the board there. So if you want to give a background to listeners on that, that might be a good place to get us rolling.
Yeah, for sure. So across the board, demand for animal protein is very much across the United States and across the developed world. We say this 100 times, but as people have more money, the first thing that they go for is more animal protein. And the developed world is very much seeing an increase in animal protein because it's complete protein. You know, it's a more minimally processed food and people are very much moving in that direction as they focus on their health and what they're feeding their families as well. So that's really great news for both beef and dairy, right? I know some specifics in dairy. Consumption is up across butter, cheese, yogurt, cottage cheese. Cottage cheese grew 12% in the last year. And, you know, we had Austin Frerich on last August to discuss his book, Barons, and he was telling us how much of a fan he is of cottage cheese. And I ate cottage cheese when I was little, but I've rediscovered it. Well, I did when I was pregnant, actually, with my little boy. And it's a fantastic protein source. It's like 13 grams of protein for 110 calories. I mean, it's absolutely fantastic. To me, it's delicious and you can do so many things with it. And so it's very understandable that this, you know, kind of old school dairy product is having a little bit of a renaissance. So I kind of love that. The 12% increase, that's such a fantastic number for dairy, you know, where sometimes we have a hard time with increasing demand with some of our traditional products like fluid milk and stuff. So consumption is very much up in dairy. The manufacturing investment in the dairy industry is absolutely booming. You know, there's, I forget exactly how many plants. I think there's 14 to 16 new processing plants in the works in the United States that are coming online from this summer up over the next couple of years. So, you know, the outlook is very, very positive for dairy. People are investing in new manufacturing and processing. It paints a hopeful picture. There's some questions later on. But, you know, to come back to where's demand? Demand is very much up for dairy protein right now. And I know that when you and I have talked a little bit that you're seeing the same in beef. Do you have a few more specifics on that?
I would refer back to Phil Bass's episode 2 on a lot of that. He did a great job of painting where we're at today in the beef industry, but it seems like beef is still very much a demand and what consumers are asking for, whether it's at the grocery store or at the restaurants as well. But the price of beef is going up because the sheer volume of beef is barely hanging on due to all-time low cow numbers in the country. And because of screwworm, because of a few other global impacts, we're also seeing lower numbers of imports coming into the United States as well. And so we're seeing more pressure on the volume of cattle in country too. So I think we're going to keep seeing a price increase. And I'm interested to see how far consumers will actually ride this wave with us. I hope they ride it all the way through. But you get to a point where I was at Costco the other day and I think I saw a steak for $18, $19 a pound. And Costco's got some great steak options. They're high quality, upper choice to prime a lot of times. But that's unreal. Like, that's a special occasion purchase for somebody. And so I think we're seeing some transition to ground beef and so forth. And I'm hoping that the dairy industry continues to provide us beef on dairy crosses to be finished out at the feedlots too. But I'm not sure how long that's going to last either, because of you talk about production increase at the plants for dairy. That's going to put more pressure on dairy heifers to be retained. And I know I didn't hear what dairy heifers were going for today, but I know they're $3,000-$4,000 depending on the level, whether it's Holstein, whether they're pregnant, all that sort of thing. Like, just unheard of. $1,000 day olds. Like, these are record prices we're seeing for animals. And same with the beef industry. Like, to buy a cow right now, a bred cow is, it depends what's where you're at in the country, but you know, sale barns are showing anywhere from $2,500 to $3,500, depending on the level and breeding that comes with it. So we got a lot of pressure points, but the cow calf industry is stronger than it's ever been as well. So we've got a lot of interesting dynamics. And I know that with the paleo diets, the keto diets, the carnivore diets, people are wanting that high quality red meat in their diet more than ever. And there's a huge, huge demand too for beef tallow as well. People are wanting the tallow as well. And so I think there's opportunity there, but we'll see how much the market can take and how much consumers can take and where the economy goes as well. Because if disposable income starts coming down, like trends may be suggesting, we may be having a different market discussion in next year or 2 years from now.
Right. Yeah. Well, all the points that you make are super salient to what we're seeing right now. I mean, the record high prices, you know, day old calves, no joke, $1,000 for a day old heifer calf. And then, yeah, you're bang on the nose for a bred heifer in the dairy industry, $3,000 to $4,000, depending on where you are and all of those sorts of things. And then, yeah, the very small herd size of the U.S. beef herd and, yeah, increasing prices for the consumer based on that. I mean, that creates a lot of pressure points, you know, that kind of dovetail across the two industries, because we do rely on each other, you know, especially the beef on dairy relationship. That's very important to us. And that brings up some questions around like resilience and innovation in the supply chain. I've got questions on genetics. You know, are we going to keep investing in genetic diversity and genetic improvement and innovation as long as calves are $1,000, you know? Like, that's some easy money. That's a quick win right there. And why would you focus on genetics in the short term when, you know, you can subsidize some other stuff like a, you know, a new build or an expansion or something like that? So it brings up a lot of questions, all the points that you just gave. And, you know, I wonder too, like, can the consumer bear that? You know, dairy product prices haven't shot up as much as beef prices. I think one of those reasons is that fluid milk is often used as a loss leader in grocery store strategies. You know, you get people in the door for cheap milk and hopefully they buy a whole bunch of stuff on their way back to the dairy case to make up for it. But cheese and butter prices have increased. My gosh, paying $4 for a pound of butter just makes me cringe, but I'm not buying anything else, so I guess I'll pay the $4. But yeah, you know, it all bears the question, where are we headed? Are we headed for an absolute boom cycle or are we in a bubble? That's a question, like you said at the beginning, this is probably going to be an episode full of more questions rather than answers, but it's fun to start digging into them and see where we're at and, you know, start speculating about where we might be going. And like you said, we are very much hobby market observers, so don't take anything we say as gospel. We have checked our facts, but we have no advice to give. What you said about, you know, are people going to want to keep selling their dairy calves to feedlots if there is that much demand expected in dairy? You know, on a long-term demand outlook, the United States is expected to have to be able to provide 40% of new milk production over the next 25 years. So that's a super long-term outlook. But that pressure is very much there. And, you know, we're going to have to meet it with a combination of innovation and creativity and technology, you know, and all of those sorts of things with the growing pressures from, you know, environmental factors and you know, population growth and all of that sort of thing. So I'm wondering, is our new manufacturing capacity, is it diversified enough to absorb a shift in consumer preferences? Or are we over-specializing? You know, are we just building all of these fluid milk plants to be able to take milk that hopefully we're going to be able to produce, you know, quickly and efficiently? Or are we building plants that are going to be able to produce things that consumers actually want over the long term? Do you have any thoughts about that and about, you know, beef product innovation as well?
Well, I think from a dairy perspective, I think about that quite often because I think of Chobani, and that one's a very public announcement on the amount of expansion Chobani itself is doing, whether it's in New York or Idaho right now. And they have different product lines as well. And so maybe they're diversified enough. But how many little yogurt cups does one cow produce? And I don't know these numbers.
We could back that up pretty quickly, but it's a lot. It's a lot.
And because yogurt demand, I've heard, is on an all-time high too. So it's right there with cottage cheese, specifically like the Greek yogurt with the high protein levels in it. And so you set up all this manufacturing to produce these little tiny cups of yogurt that one person may eat once a day, even if we fill country. And then all of a sudden we decide that yogurt's bad for us and we're done. Right. Like, but that's how sensitive those markets are. It takes an RFK Jr. or it takes a Kamala Harris, or it takes, you can name anybody on either side of the political. I don't want to pinpoint a political party or get political here at all, but you take one influence. Taylor Swift could even be that person.
Probably Taylor Swift has more influence than either one of the others you just mentioned.
Probably. I've had way too much caffeine today. And so, but they come in and say, Greek yogurt is bad and now we want regular yogurt. Or Go-Gurt is now the way to go. Do we have enough flexibility even to shift that market and the little cup fillers? Like, what's the price of a cup filler? And I don't know these answers, but you followed trends, but it seems like the guys that are doing ingredients might have a little more sustainability in the long run rather than the specialty because they can ebb and flow. So if you're producing, say, powdered milk or whey protein, you can stop at a maybe a more fluid product, or you can continue to process it down to an ingredient that then can be diversified or re-wetted down in some form or fashion. So I'm just throwing these at the wall. I have no idea, but I look at, you know, some of these big packing houses too, and they don't further process. Like they're doing boxed beef and primals. And so they send them to grocery stores. They send them to further processing. They send them to restaurants to break down those steaks there. And so they keep it as big as they can or at an efficient shipping rate to get it out the door because they don't know what their end consumer is wanting. And so if somebody can specialize in making briskets and the value added, you shift the risk down to those guys. And then what's their risk? Is the corned beef market going to be strong forever? Is the jerky industry going to be strong? And how do you risk management in those situations too? So I think the innovation comes with some of the risk management and the ability to quickly shift. And the COVID, I brought that to light.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question to ask because it brings up the idea of product innovation, but also like manufacturing diversity and resilience. And let's break those two things down. So, I mean, I know from Dr. Bass's episode that he touched on, you know, that breaking down from the initial harvest plant to the value-added products all the way down the chain until it ends up on your dinner plate in the fancy steak restaurant that you go to once a year because now steaks are $18 a piece. But there's an awful lot of manual labor still involved in beef processing, especially that's really, really hard to automate, right? And dairy processing has become very much more mechanized, but as you say, specialized from like a yogurt line versus just a fluid line where you can, you know, you can separate cream and then skim, and then you can go off and make those into further products, you know, in the same plant. And so I don't know the answer to this. This would be a really cool one to dive into for another episode. But, you know, I know that manufacturing plants across the board, not just agriculture, not just food, but across the board are investing in AI technology for things like preventative maintenance. So they can identify a problem using machine learning or artificial intelligence to do preventative maintenance before they have to, but also not necessarily on a regular schedule where they're spending more resources than they actually need to. And so I'm wondering if that can be shifted into some shape or form to be able to create processing resilience and diversity so that you could flip over from a yogurt line more easily, you know, into something else. And I am not an expert on dairy processing. I am very much not. I come from the other end of the cow, that's for sure. But, you know, that's a question that I have. Like, are people out there thinking about this? Are they focusing on it to be able to be more nimble and change quickly, for example, when something like COVID comes along? That's a question. I don't know. You probably don't have an answer, but that's a question that I have, you know. And I mean, Dr. Bass talked about a few things that are coming along in the beef industry, you know, for like heat capture, energy capture, and that sort of stuff. But what's happening in manufacturing plants and processing plants to encourage diversity and resilience? I don't know the answer to that.
Well, and I think a lot of that right now is shifting how quickly can we get product through the door at the most efficient rate that they possibly can. Because right now, the packing industry specifically is the one that's hurting the worst in the beef industry, because they're having to buy high-priced cattle and sell a high-priced product on the back end. So their margins are thin. And so I think the big four are taking a hit more now than they ever used to. Let me clarify. They have the least amount of margin right now than any other sector. And that has shifted since 5-6 years ago, when the big packers were the bad guys because they had all the margin and the cattle guys didn't have the margin. And so everything shifts. And so I think it's one, recognizing this, what I hope they have a lot of resilience, because we're going to need the packing space when the industry flips again and we have cows on the market. So it's making sure that we're not cutting packing space, but we're cutting packing time and able to still make our capital costs and that sort of thing. Because when it shifts, the worst that could happen is somebody goes out of business that controls 25% of the market or processes 25% of the market. And so hoping that those big guys are resilient. You know, we had recent talk about the ag labor situation, and there was a couple plants that had quite a few employees deported last week. And so we're looking at labor situations too. And that's going to be that's always an ongoing situation for manufacturing. It doesn't matter whether you're in automotive, agriculture, what part. Ag labor is always going to be forefront of our minds. And so, you know, I think it's trying to figure out how we can use maybe AI and some technologies to start making some like physical cuts in the carcasses, because carcasses come in at different sizes and scales. They try really hard to get them at a certain point, but they're 200-300 pound differences sometimes, and the rib spacing's different and that sort of thing. And if you have a machine cutting every 3 inches, you're going to hit a rib occasionally.
Right.
And so it's really hard to automate some of that. Whereas, you know, your milk comes in as fluid, and there's not, you might have different volumes, but you're still going to have the same product.
It's a lot easier to standardize it. Yeah.
Consistency that maybe a beef carcass doesn't quite have.
Right. I mean, automating a beef carcass breakdown would be like getting a machine to fold every piece of laundry in your house. Like, there's so many different things that it has to learn, and they're all so disparate. So I can totally imagine how that would be a huge challenge in the beef sector.
Hi, I'm Tom Herron, founder of Ag Professionals. Agriculture is always innovating and evolving, and at Ag Professionals, we provide the expertise to help you stay ahead. From land use planning and environmental compliance, permitting to real estate, civil and environmental engineering, and land surveying, we offer one-stop solutions you need to grow and succeed. We're proud to support the Millennial Ag Podcast because we believe in the future of agriculture. Let's build that future together. Visit our website, agpros.com, to learn how we can help your operation thrive.
And coming back to like the big four that you were talking about, you know, what happens if there's a break there? And we've said this, you know, several times on the podcast. We dang near saw, you know, the supply chain break during COVID, you know, or if all of a sudden someone who has 25% of the market share is out, they lose that much of their labor force that they are just down for a while. You know, the big players dominate, but what about creating local systems or local processing systems that would build producer resilience I know that this was a major topic of discussion during COVID. Everyone and their brother, it seemed like, was talking about, well, we're going to build a slaughterhouse. We're going to build a kill plant. You know, we're going to have them all over the countryside. And, you know, I don't think that people thought about like the capital cost to get that up and running. But are we at a space where, you know, building community scale processing could support not just resilience, but product diversity and margin capture? And again, I know the capex on that is ridiculous for beef and for dairy, but are we getting to a point where that might actually be a reasonable thing to start thinking about?
I think we're in the trial phase of it right now, to be quite honest. We have, I think North Platte came online in Nebraska. We've had two or three mid-sized packers here in Idaho right now. And it takes 2, 3, 4 years to start killing cattle. Once you pick a site and say, we're going to go for it, you've got all the permitting, engineering, and construction that's a year or two in itself, talking about the amount of concrete, the concrete walls, the manufacturing inside of it. And so you have to have enough capital cost and know your risk to get into it. And so those guys are now currently operating. And so we'll see if it's a resilience or not at this point. And we'll see if they can withstand the current market, because packers, when they come in, packer margins are good. By the time they get up and running, packing margins are small. And so the big guys help the industry out because they can ride those changes in market really well. The smaller packing guys have a tougher time with the change in those margins. And so it's going to be interesting to see how that happens or what happens there. I know this is interesting too, because they get to a point where they don't have enough funding. And so Walmart comes in and buys them out or somebody like that. So now we're back with the big boys running the show again, because we need that capital investment in there. And so guys, people in general bashing on the big boys gets me a little frustrated. Is there issues with it and having oligopolies and a few people running? Yes, but they can process beef a lot cheaper than anybody else in the country and have found ways to be efficient that some of the mid-sized packers are trying to figure out right now. And so we'll see if there's resiliency in it, but there's also a lot of risk. And so we'll see what the next few years, I think, will be a big telling sign. And I think if we look back at cyclical markets, this happens all the time. Mid-size come in, big guys go out, big guys come back in, mid-size, you know, it just fluctuates back and forth. And depending on what consumers want, and if those mid-size packers have a market for their beef, I think a lot of times they say, well, we want to kill our own cattle. We want all our neighbors to kill at this local plant, but they haven't been able to get the product to market yet. So there's an extra step that sometimes the people that actually own the cattle don't have experience in. So it's making sure you have your full supply chain and plugging in. You know, you can sell calves at 700 pounds and somebody else takes the risk to get them to finish. And then packers take the risk, they break them down. So by doing that, we're diversifying risk throughout the supply chain rather than having all the risk on one animal. So that was a long-winded answer. And I don't think I even answered your question, but that's where my brain goes on some of that. I don't think there's a correct answer. And I think we're going to have to wait and see where we end up.
Yeah, definitely just see as we go along for sure. And I know, I mean, you know, you get a pie in the sky dream and all, you hate the big guys and I'm mad and all of these sorts of things. I'm not saying this is just beef, but I'm going to start my own thing. Gosh darn it. And I mean, spite can only take you so far. I mean, the realities that you're talking about, I mean, the big four, are the big four for a reason, right? And that's one of the reasons that we have a stable and abundant food supply. But we can get into that later. But I was just thinking about the enormous amount of investment it takes to make even a mid-size, even a small plant, right? And it's the same on the dairy side. I mean, the hardware, because I work in the ag tech sector, you know, the tangible assets themselves, you know, pipelines and wash systems and water and concrete and, you know, all of those things that you talk about before you even get product in the door to start turning it into something more valuable is mind boggling. And you start to wonder, okay, where are the margins and how can we make money there? And a thought that crossed my mind while you were talking about that was, you know, there's a lot of interest in investment, you know, like in the ag tech sector, into AI, into machine learning and all of that sort of stuff. And I wonder, I have no idea. This is something that just barely crossed my mind, but is there interest in there from investment funds who might be interested in helping break up the supply chain a little bit and investing in some of those smaller, either like a community of 5 or 6 beef producers in a community, or, you know, a couple of dairies that want to get together and start their own processing. I have no idea. That's a question I want to ask here. And listeners, if you've heard of anything like that, please give us a holler, because I would love to hear about that. And that's not just because my own little heart goes pitter patter at the thought of having a cheese plant.
Well, and I think, or at least we saw this during COVID, but there was a lot more grants for that too. So I think there might be some structure, depending on the season of the economy we're into. And a lot of those are federal government grants to help support things. But I think there could be grants and stuff. And the concern I have with that is that the Bill Gates Investment Trust Fund is going to come invest in something and then want control or want input in it, you know, rather than just a donation to get this started.
Right. That's always a concern, right? Like, you line up some pretty cool investors who are all excited about what you're doing, and you're excited that they're excited, and oh my gosh, here comes the money, and then they want control. And, you know, we are in agriculture, and we've said it 100 times on this podcast. We are very independent people, and we don't like being told what to do by people who don't come from ag, or even people inside ag. But, you know, you get some money lined up, you build a good relationship with someone who wants to see you do something cool, and then all of a sudden they're telling you what to do. So I can see how that would be a concern too. But, you know, I'm sure that there's lawyers out there wily enough to protect your interests. So
I think it's having everything on the table too, like not just saying no to that, but also so being wildly cautious when getting into or taking a leap of faith on some of this, because there's a lot of risk that comes into manufacturing and processing.
Right. Absolutely. And I mean, a lot of it, what you said about, you know, markets, factors of economics, you know, and even changing consumer preferences that could take you from a yogurt line to who the heck knows what. Although I tell you what, going back to that, you know, if we're reliant on Go-Gurts and the beef jerky industry to keep us going, my children will do it single-handedly. Those are the two favorite snacks in our house. That and string cheese, but.
Convenient, high quality, easy protein is what's going to keep our industry alive. You know, it's the chicken nuggets have kept the poultry industry wildly successful. Like, you see chicken nuggets on every menu, and you can buy chicken nuggets, eat them in the truck as you're driving down the road. And we've all got to learn to adapt and provide products that can make our lives easier, because I don't think the United States is slowing down any time as far as how busy we are as human beings. Like, everybody I talk to, the amount of people that are zooming around on the roads too, like, nobody looks like they've got time to kill anymore. And so the easier we can make grabbing high quality protein in the grocery stores or at
gas stations, or
yeah, the more product we're going to move.
That's a really interesting point right there, because you and I have talked recently about this, like about the way that we work and how much we work. And like, it's very much a Western thing. It's very much an agriculture thing. And I've got some beef with it, pardon the pun. but you're right. Like, we work 1,000 miles an hour now. We work on the road all the time. And convenience is, I mean, it is worth its weight in gold to me, both as a professional, as a mom, I mean, as my own Catherine self. But something that I have been really encouraged by is that the market has responded to that. And now if you go into a gas station, you don't just get, you know, the only option isn't, you know, Cheetos and, you know, a Slurpee or something like that. Like, there's little charcuterie boxes, there's pickles, there's string cheese. And okay, like, it's $3 for a freaking string cheese, but still, it's a string cheese and there's 5 grams of protein in it. There's much healthier options and there's a lot more animal protein options at places like gas stations that make me feel less bad about eating gas station food for lunch while I'm flying around the countryside. And it costs a lot more than it should, but it's what I want to eat. And so the market has responded really, really well to that. And I think that that is an encouraging sign that we're going in the right direction. Convenience, high quality protein, animal protein, you know, all those things that you said, that's just like a really good crystallization of how far we have come in being able to address those consumer wants and demands.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you talk about $3 for a string cheese and yeah, that's expensive for a string cheese, but it's cheaper than going to McDonald's. It's cheaper than going and buying a burger. And so, like, if you can get a string cheese and a beef stick for $5 together and a bag of pickles, your belly's not going to hurt when you haven't consumed all the grease and you're sitting around. I love me a good McDonald's. This is not a bash on McDonald's.
Right. Don't get us wrong, but.
But when you just need a quick protein and you've been sitting in the truck, absolutely. $6 is cheaper than a lunch anywhere.
Yeah.
You can go buy one.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, that's a cool point to make. I like that a lot. You know, we've covered a lot of ground really fast. We're only 33 minutes in, and usually you and I say on one of our own episodes, oh, we'll just talk for 20 minutes, and then we talk for an hour. But like you said, I think we've both had a lot of caffeine today, and we're talking really fast. But one thing that we haven't touched on yet are costs of manufacturing and inputs, so inflation, and then labor. Both of those things are really top industry concerns. We've talked about labor a lot. You know, we talked about it along with tariffs. We've talked about it as it relates to AI and machine learning. Do you have any new insights or things to discuss in that realm as we're talking about the market outlook today?
No, I wish I did. I think people on specifically the ag labor, I've heard more threats of layoffs and stuff like that at plants. I think it's primarily because of the current administration's push to make sure that we have citizens working and that we don't have undocumented workers here in the country. I think he's backed off a little bit on that, but I think people are gearing up for not having employees or figuring out that. So I think people are just clenching, and I haven't talked to any processors lately, but I think it's a ride the wave at this point and see what happens, because you can't really predict what's going to happen, you know? And so you have to keep operating and getting product out the door. And I'm sure the executive team in the closed room of the back office are starting to discuss this, but I don't know what's going to happen. And I don't, if I look through my crystal ball, the glass is going to get in my eye when it comes to those topics.
So it's like Dr. Bass's cloudy crystal ball. My crystal ball doesn't work. You know, I don't have a whole lot to add to it besides, like, on the immigration front. I mean, we've got a talent shortage across the board, particularly in skilled roles. You know, whether that's a really high-skilled cow person on a dairy, a cowboy who really know what he's doing on a feedlot, someone skilled in manufacturing roles. You know, I know that incentives like flexible hours and higher pay haven't really solved the problem. And we're facing that shortage even with immigrant labor, you know. And so the crackdown on immigrant labor, again, a discussion we can have 1,000 times over, and it'll change daily until the day that we die. But there's just a shortage of talent in general. And there's a lot of factors in that. Aging populations, you know, people who are interested in those kind of blue collar jobs are interested in the hard work and the manual labor, blah, 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 the same old things, right? But I think that there are things that we need to keep on our mind, you know, in our heads, just to keep them up there to think about ways to address them. And I know that AI and machine learning are going to have a huge, huge impact on this. And they already are. It's more difficult in agriculture because, again, it is manual labor. You know, it's bespoke processing, for lack of a better term. A lot of variables in there, right? But I know, you know, I've talked before about the company I work for, the robotic solutions that we have are really driving some really great ROI on being able to address labor costs. But it's new technology, right? And does a producer take the chance to invest in that and try something new when things are so uncertain and volatile? Or does he go with what he knows, which is a guy to stand there at the cow and spray her and clean her and put a machine on her, you know? And so I can understand it from both sides. You know, the payback could be 2 or 3 to 1, but it's a risk, right? And there's so many risks across this business. Which one do you take? Because you need to take the 1 or 2 that are going to give you the biggest payoff the fastest.
And I think, too, we have to have reliability. So it's proving our technology out, too, at this point, because if the robot goes down, do you have another robot to take its place? You know, when a human is sick, you can usually find somebody else to go milk. Sometimes it's the owner, sometimes it's the kids, sometimes it's whoever, but you can go find another person to fill in, you know. And so I can't remember who said that the other day to me, but it made me think, like, we've got to get to a point where our technology can have substitutes, right? Because it's going to break down.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I've heard guys, you know, we're lucky enough to run across some pioneers and some early adopters who will take a chance on us, right? And that's really awesome. But there's a lot of guys out there who are a lot more resistant, not in a like a bullheaded way, but more of a, I need to see where this is going to go. It needs to be refined. We know that AI is crucial to improving efficiency and supporting technical talent, but it doesn't solve all the problems. And it, you know, it's going to be a dovetail effort for sure. But just like anything else, people are going to want to see the maturity in it before I think that it's adopted, you know, on a really, really wide scale.
And I think we also need to focus on putting robotics and technology in places that can make the work environment safer too. Thinking about even the crowd gates, right? Like having those automatic crowd gates have helped people not get smashed or kicked by cows. Having some of those knife jobs at the plant start to be automated so we're not slicing fingers, you know, and we would retain labor, I think, a little bit better if we can make our jobs a little bit safer, because agriculture is a dangerous industry.
It is, especially if you aren't paying attention or you aren't fully engaged in what you're doing. It's pretty easy to get hurt, and that could be on the kill floor, that can be in a corral, in a parlor, out in the fields, anywhere, right? Like, it's across the board. I mean, heck, being in the boardroom can be pretty dangerous sometimes, too.
Me walking across the parking lot.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I guess, you know, we've covered a ton of ground in this episode. It's been fun to think about. We've bopped all over the place. I guess, you know, two closing questions. One, what gives you optimism in the beef sector? Because we always like to end with a bit of optimism.
Optimistically, just having beef demand be continually strong and having consumers believe in our product enough to pay the prices at the grocery stores and continue to order it gives me so much hope for the future. We'll figure out how to produce more beef, or we'll figure out how to make the carcass go further. We continue to innovate in genetics and, you know, what we feed our cows and those sorts of things. So I have optimism in the people in the industry, and then I have optimism in the demand for beef. We'll see where the markets go. Again, I don't have a crystal ball, but it doesn't seem like cow numbers are increasing anytime soon, or at least not in the next 6 months. And we'll see what the sale numbers look like this fall. But I have optimism in our consumers, and they're the people buying our product. And I think we'll be in business for a long time.
People got to eat, right?
What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of points of optimism. Obviously, you know, increased demand for our awesome, awesome products is always fantastic. But for me, one of my new levels of optimism comes from the sector that I'm working in now, which is ag tech in the dairy space. And I am so excited by the prospects of what using AI and machine learning can turn data into actionable insights for our dairy producers. And those actionable insights lead to incredible gains in efficiency and profitability. That is what I'm really excited about. You know, we talk about technology, and when we were growing up, technology was RFID tags, and it was, you know, scanners and milk meters and all that sort of stuff, like hardware technology. You know, and now we're taking it a step further. We're using all that data that we've been gathering for my entire lifetime, and we're turning it into something that will create an even higher profit margin for producers. And I love that. I'm super, super excited about that.
No, I think that's awesome. And keep giving people opportunities to stay in business for the long term and talk about sustainability, you know, I think that's pretty incredible. So any last words of wisdom you have, Catherine, before we sign off?
Yeah, I've been thinking, Val, like, what is one thing that beef and dairy, each sector, could or should prioritize? Again, we are not here to give advice, just our opinions. Something that each sector should avoid or should prioritize to avoid being blindsided. And I've got my answer. Do you want me to go or you want to go first?
You go first.
Mine is keeping your eye on the ball as far as tariffs go. And we haven't talked about tariffs at all on this episode. But, you know, don't be blindsided by short-term sparky things in the market. Take the long view and focus on the long-term market opportunities. And that's really hard to do. I mean, I know that sensations in the news and that sort of stuff, it's easy for you to bounce. And, you know, I'm not running an operation right now, but I know that some of the best guys out there do keep their eye, you know, on the long-term out there. So that's just what's crossed my mind.
I love that. Maybe just to piggyback off, just making sure that we're continuing to set goals and prioritize what's best for our operations and making sure we're plugging into the industry as a whole. But the way individual operations work is very different from one another. And so making sure you're not comparing yourself to the neighbor and making sure you're doing what's best for you and making your goals and target and how to get there too is really, really important. It's definitely plugging in things, but making sure that you're evaluating what works best for you in the long run.
Yeah, continuous innovation and improvement and curiosity to adopt and try new things, I think.
Yep, absolutely.
before we wrap up, again, we've covered a ton of stuff. And listeners, if you, you know, heard one of our points and thought, oh my gosh, I could come on and speak to that, or I've got the perfect person to answer that question that Valor Catherine posed, we would love to have those suggestions from you, because we are loving bringing on industry experts and hearing from the people who are really in the sauce, you know, working on these challenges every single day. So if you've got a suggestion, throw it our way.
Yep, most definitely. And we appreciate you continually tuning in. Please share this with your friends and family and like and review, because we want to get in the algorithms a little bit more. So we thank you for tuning into this week's episode.
Thank you for tuning into this week's episode of the Millennial Ag Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your friends and like, subscribe, and review to our podcast. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or email us at talktous@millennialag.com. Until next week, we are Millennial Ag.